Hey guys, this episode is brought to you by Huawei. You've probably noticed that our country is on a bit of a fitness kick. Everywhere you turn, people are obsessed with health and exercise. Now, not all of you are marathon runners. I just happen to be. Or world-class athletes. I am not. But that's okay, because the Huawei Fit is the first fitness tracker for literally everybody. It's got a sleek and stylish design that pairs well with basically every outfit, so no matter what your workout looks like, the Huawei was made for you. Anyways, visit huawei.fit/cracked now to purchase your Huawei Fit. Again, that's huawei.fit/cracked. Tech pioneer VMware dropped a couple of IT guys into classic sci-fi movies like Star Wars, The Matrix, Terminator. If I can name a ton of movies off the top of my head that would have been wrapped up in 5 minutes had anyone had a cell phone or known how to use one. It's called IT is Greater Than Sci-Fi, and you can listen to it at vmware.com/radius/sci-fi, or you can download it from the iTunes store or wherever fine podcasts are served. That is IT is Greater Than Sci-Fi.
Starts in a boat behind the bank. And every evening when he gets home.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor in chief of Cracked, and this week we're listening to Summer Teeth, the titular track off of Wilco's second album, third album, because of this chorus right here.
It's just a dream he keeps having.
Because this episode, we're talking about human psychology. And I grew up thinking my dreams meant something. And it turns out that's not true. I didn't have to spend all those years worrying about the fact that my teeth kept falling out of my head in every dream. Human psychology is actually a lot like space, the subject of last week's episode, in that a lot of what just popped into your mind when I said the subject of the episode is human psychology are probably myths and outdated beliefs and just general bullshit. It's not your fault. We just don't learn about those subjects beyond, for the vast majority of us, you know, Psych 101, at most, seventh grade science when it comes to space. Beyond that, movies are where I get the vast majority of my assumptions about how the inside of our brains work and how physics works in space. The movie Gravity really fucked me up when it comes to physics, because it's one of those movies that makes an official claim to realism, from the opening Chiron about how space is trying to kill you to the realistic astronaut suits. But someone in a recent pitch in our workshop pointed out that they don't get even very basic physics right. There's that scene where George Clooney falls away from the orbiting spacecraft he and Sandra Bullock are on, and Sandra Bullock and him are strapped together, and Sandra Bullock's foot gets tangled in a cord that's wrapped around the spacecraft and it stops them. Now, according to science, once that cord stopped them, they'd be stopped. They're in orbit, so effectively zero gravity. Once the cord became taut and stopped them, they'd stop moving, maybe even snap back a little bit. There's no more force pulling on them. But in the movie, some imaginary force just keeps pulling him out into space, to the point that he realizes if he doesn't unclip himself from Sandy Bullock, he's going to pull her with him. So he has to release himself and is carried off to his heroic death by some force unknown to Newton when he sketched out his laws of motion. Point is, it's an incredibly important part of the movie that relies on just nonsense science, made up force. But because we've never been in zero gravity and we've seen that force with our own eyes in a dramatic, memorable moment, it's a lot realer to us than what would actually happen. So why am I talking your ear off about space? That was last week's episode. Because I'm easily distractible and have ADD, and once you get me talking about movies, I sort of lose all sense of time. But also, you may have plenty of experience with how humans behave, but when it comes to explaining why we behave the way we do, most of us get at most one college course, like I said. And other than that, it's the psychiatrists and mentalists, not a real profession, that we see on TV and in movies. Now, your best guessing might be better when it comes to human psychology than your best guessing about how astronauts behave in zero gravity, since you have real-world experience with humans every day, most of you, hopefully. Our demographic data tells us that less than 1% of our listeners are being held captive with only a TV and an iPod, old boy style, or raised in the wilderness like Nell. So we're not as clueless as we are with astronaut physics, but when it comes to psychology, the mistaken beliefs are way more important. For instance, for most of my childhood and early adulthood, I believed that some random interpretation of what I thought ink blots looked like could be used by trained professionals to determine if I was insane. I believed that I secretly hated my father and had sexual feelings about my mother, even if neither of those things were remotely true, as far as I could tell. I was apparently just repressing those feelings. I believed I could be repressing an entire person if I had something called split personalities. Psychiatric hospitals, in my mind, were terrifying places where they would take the electric paddles that real hospitals use to shock your heart back into working order. They would take those, put them to your temples, and electrocute your fucking brain. That's what they had instead of medicine in psychiatric hospitals. You know, I was terrified of going to therapy because they might tell me about some other bizarre sexual impulses I was forcing myself to ignore. In the world of human psychology, totally innocent things mean totally perverse and disturbing things about who you are deep down. Thinking an ink blot looks like a butterfly means you've got an anal fixation or whatever. Girls who are annoyed by their little brothers, it's because they wish they had a penis like him. And those ideas show up in smart movies and TV shows like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Sopranos. And as with a lot of what we learned about space, the very tiny bit of psychology that most of us got in school was also pretty flawed. The psychological experiments that proved you would murder a stranger if a person in a white lab coat told you to, or the famous story that says you wouldn't call the cops if you saw a woman get murdered and you thought there were like 30 other people who are watching too, you'd just be like, nah, they've got it. Or that if you were put in charge of prisoners, you'd immediately begin abusing them because your heart is just pure black coal. Don't act like you don't secretly want to put on a pair of reflective aviators, grow a mustache, and beat some people for not addressing you as sir. And then there are the places that we trust ourselves too much. Like, we naturally believe that we remember things the way they actually happened. Memory is one place we should actually be less confident about how our mind works than we naturally are. But instead of pumping the brakes a little bit, we have thousands of TV shows and movies that imply that memories are just grainy black and white versions of just what actually happened, versus basically two that depict memory working the way it actually works. That would be Rashomon and that episode of Fresh Prince, where Uncle Phil takes Will and Carlton to court for having a pool party, and we see the pool party through both of their subjective points of view. Anyways, movies and accepted wisdom basically hit the brakes where we don't trust our minds enough and hit the gas where we're overly confident, which leaves us with a lot of really harmful assumptions that you're making every day, and which makes this the most important episode of anything ever done anywhere ever. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Lucky to have you here.
his kitchen, in your chair. Sometimes he forgets that you're even there. It's just a dream he keeps having. And it doesn't seem to mean anything. It's just a dream he keeps having.
UCB Sunset. Hi, my name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and joining me on stage, a writer and editor for Cracked Video, one of the two Kurt Vonnegut guys, my occasional co-host, Mr. Michael Swain!
Hiya, hiya, hiya. I got a new epithet.
Yeah. Over there. The head of Cracked Video, the legs that just won't quit. Please welcome Mr. Daniel O'Brien!
Legs that just won't quit. Is that
my new? Just okay. Won't quit.
The rest of you has been laid off. I'm sorry to inform
you.
No relation, right? We're not related. Is that correct?
I sent out some blood from both of us to a guy I know, and he's gonna get back to me.
On a number of topics.
Also, I took some of your blood.
Oh. Weird. And joining us this week, a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's published work on expectations, emotional accounting. He regularly appears on the BBC and Wired and the WSJ, which I believe is the Wall Street Journal. He's studied with Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, so I'm kind of nerding out right now. Please welcome Dr. Peter McGraw.
Hi, everyone.
I thought this was still me. I thought it was still me. Okay.
Tell us, did he set the expectations way too high? Have we now doomed the show? You would know.
I think it's, you know, it's not always a good sign when you have to introduce someone. One of their big things they've done is worked with someone even bigger.
Well, thanks for being here. Today we're talking about the 20 greatest nut shots in movie history.
Let's roll that reel. That's why we needed Dan's legs here.
Yeah. I really wish
I'm
we were doing
I'm gonna kick you in the nuts, dude. You look confused.
No, we're talking about psychology, obviously. I feel like it's the thing that we make the most bullshit assumptions about just in our daily lives. Like, we need to know how it works because we are thinking human beings. And I think most of our information on how it works comes from common sense, BuzzFeed quizzes.
Or the telephone game, like the filtration process. Like one of the ones we discussed before the show was the five stages of grieving, which is one of those things that through osmosis I just picked up. Mm-hmm. Maybe I first saw it in the Simpsons episode where Bart is grieving. But otherwise, like, I don't know why I learned it, and I did assume it was true, and it's definitely not. Can you confirm that, Peter?
True, not true.
True that it's not true.
Yes,
that's the sorry, not sorry of psychology.
All of our
but the Jacker is right about our general willingness to accept almost, like, if I see any movie or TV show where someone says, according to psychology, this is what you're supposed to do now, I believe that. I unconditionally believe it. And I won't believe it if someone on TV is like, well, according to math, I'm like, ah, the jury's still out on math.
Yeah, I think most of what I know is The Sopranos and Frasier. How much of your education is Frasier-based?
Like 1%, actually, yeah. There's
toss salad and
scrambled. There was
eggs.
A scene with the dog that was shown in class, but that was it. Yeah, I think it's so appealing because we all want to know not only why we do what, like, I often look myself in the mirror and go, like, what the hell are you doing, man? Why are you doing any
buddy.
Of the things you're doing? And I assume you all do that every morning and night as well.
I do. I also wonder why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
What the fuck is Michael
what
doing?
What the fuck's he doing, buddy? But you know what I mean? Like, ever since I saw Sherlock Holmes or an analog dress someone down perfectly, it's so appealing to be an armchair psychologist and, like, observe a thing at a party and go, like, oh, I bet this happened in that person's childhood because of something I heard about Freud. Or just, like, I don't know, you get in a tiff with a friend and you go, like, I get it. You're projecting because of that thing last week. And it's like, you don't know what projecting is. You just heard that either on a reality show or a movie or something. And at least I use them willy-nilly.
Yeah, I feel like it's just a logical fuck up that we're trying to study a thing with the thing itself. It just ends up not working so well. So all of this stuff is like stuff that I went into my job at Cracked believing and then was shocked to find out that it wasn't true. Most of my education was movie-based, so you'll have to bear with me. But one of the big ones that I wanted to kick things off with is how memory works. In movies, memory just tends to be like a slightly grainy black and white version of exactly what happened. And then you can access details of what happened by getting hit on the head, which I never thought was actually true, but like, you know, having somebody tell Jason Bourne the right sentence.
Well, that's what's crazy is it's become so acceptable that then you get a later day show like House where it's acceptable for someone, yeah, to use like the word lugubrious in a sentence, and he's like, lugubrious, stares into space, cuts to zooming in on like the tag of a guy's shirt, and he's like, now I know what it's
right. It's been normalized by shows like House and Monk and Psych, where someone is trying to remember something, and then they're just like, remember harder, and then it goes into black and white, and he's like, oh, that's right, there was this mouse on the floor that was like holding up a sign that said, I'm guilty. I've never seen Monk. I assume that's what it's like.
Well, then how'd you just spoil the finale?
But at that point, that like a character can just like remember something harder, and then they pick up a detail of something in the room. And this is real talk. I could not tell you what kind of pants Michael is wearing right now, and I've been with him for the last like 45
minutes. Not applicable.
I can't see them right now, and like no matter how hard you tell me to remember, I'm not gonna get it. I'm not gonna know because I have a real memory.
Yeah. Now I want to know.
Well, I feel like, Peter, you must know something about, yeah, the fallibility of, let's say, eyewitness testimony or just the fallibility of memory in general. And I think it's pretty shocking for people who haven't heard how fallible the human memory is. It's
terrifying, actually, yeah. The notion that we rely on eyewitnesses, the fact that we haven't changed the system knowing what we know about how much you can influence a witness and how much they want to remember. It's they're not comfortable saying, I don't remember. And so they do their best to recreate things.
But they don't know they're doing that. So that's the tricky thing, is that we think we can do the thing they do in the movies,
right,
where you're like, oh, yeah, okay, now I have that detail. But you're just fucking making that up. Like, that's how memory works. It's like you can come up with new details, but any details you're realizing after the fact, you're just making it up, essentially.
I mean, it's not random, right? The idea is that these are sort of plausible memories, right? So, you know, they're built on scripts, they're built on prior knowledge, and as I said, they can be suggestible. Like, so Elizabeth Loftus, who's done, I think, some of the best work in this area, shows how kind of easy it is to plant memories into people's mind, and even just describing a situation with a different word. You know, when the two cars hit versus crashed, changes the details of what people actually recall seeing, broken glass on the ground and so on in this way. You know, they're just doing their best, but their best is often not good enough when it's a court of law,
right,
I suppose.
Yeah. Just as a shout out, I'll shout out Darren Brown, who's like a hypnotist / magician. And so much of hypnotism, I feel like, was people fumbling around and stumbling upon all these like ways to hotwire the memory programs. And rather than studying it and becoming the branch of like knowledge that we call psychology, there's a subset of people who are like, I'll just fuck with people with this. Things we figured out. Just any video with Darren Brown, there's a great thing with Simon Pegg where he asks Simon Pegg what he always wanted for Christmas as a boy, and after a long conversation basically gets implanted in his brain an elaborately detailed story that he wanted a red bike with a particular handle and seat, and they bring it out and they're like, well, happy Merry Christmas. And he's like, the reality is you didn't want that. That is not a real story from your childhood. I have it scripted here. And yet seeing that and hearing this, and I've seen like things about memory many times, I still don't believe it. I'm like, I wouldn't fall for it. Like, everyone thinks they wouldn't fall for that.
Yeah, but no, Michael, don't you remember that time you and I were together in India and you
fell for
it?
Yeah, no, of course, yeah.
Elizabeth Loftus, like one of her experiments, there's like a more reasonable one where she gets people to remember seeing Bugs Bunny at Disney World, even though Bugs Bunny's not a Disney property, and so like they couldn't have seen him. But then there's one where she gets...
She's just like, got you, idiot! Loftus!
Loftus out! There's another one where she gets people to remember going up in a hot air balloon, even though they've never been in a hot air balloon before.
That seems so objectively quantifiable.
The fuck can you
see? I'm learning this for the first time, and I'm not too scared because it sounds like it's just this person, Elizabeth Loftus, who's using this special power to fuck with people about Disneyland and balloons. But should I be worried? Like, are cops and lawyers taking advantage of this? Did they know this before I did? And like, are
like, I feel like trial is there a lawyer?
Is there a lawyer that's like the best in the country at tricking people? Should I monger
see,
some fear right now?
There's your monk show, a hypnotist lawyer who just hacks the jury. That's your show,
Loftus.
So I think that, well, to answer your question, you know, nowadays what happens is you hire experts who then take the stand and then talk about how you can't rely on this eyewitness testimony. So those behavioral sciences find their way either through advising, like, oh, you should ask questions this way, or even as expert witnesses.
That's such a crazy evolution of trials that, like, I'm going to bring up my witness who was there and is going to tell you what happened. Okay, counter witness, my person is going to talk about how memory is a lie. Everything is bullshit.
Right.
You can't trust.
Yeah, them. Just like a scientist comes up and is like, they didn't see any of that shit.
Special surprise witness, philosopher who will explain why justice is imaginary.
Right.
It's not even a concept. Why are we here?
They're just going to bring up David Blaine, who's going to be like, look, there's a card in your mouth. See, nothing's real. It's fine.
Just go, run, dude, run now.
Yeah, but I feel like that is genuinely a problem because you can have an expert come up and be like, memory is fallible. But if you have a person like standing there being like, I swear it was that person that I saw, the jury's going to believe that person. And like one of the things they had to outlaw was showing people mugshots. Like it was a certain way of showing people mugshots because they would just fill in one of the faces from the mugshots they saw into the crime that they had witnessed. And they were, like, falsely accusing
Wasn't
people.
Wasn't that... It was the classic, like, photo board.
Right, exactly.
But they would reuse people. And, yeah, so you'd slowly start to get to know which one they're guiding you toward.
So I want to ask you guys this. So you were talking about seeing this stuff in movies and TV and so on. And so really what it seems to me is that you have writers who are perpetuating myths, and then you have viewers who never question the myths. And so then
just shit on everyone in the room, Peter. Great.
Well, not these guys now.
Psychologists who
who are sitting there going, "That's bullshit. That's bullshit."
The darkness,
right? Yeah.
And we're very grateful you are.
This is even easier than you might think because of so there's a bunch of research on how narratives transport audiences. So the state of mind that you are in when you watch a movie, you read a book, watch a television show, is a mindset that's not very questioning. That is, that you're sort of transported into the story and almost carried along in this with the story. And it actually takes something really profound for someone to go, wait a second, and break that moment of transportation. And so these myths don't do it because they're plausible enough that the knock on the head, that's not enough for people to go, wait, hold on a second.
Yeah, we've talked about like the narrative logic in movies before and like Christopher Nolan is kind of a master at this, where while you're watching the movie, it makes total sense. But then afterwards, if you like just like come in for a second, you're like, wait, Batman went into the tunnel and it was day and he came out and it was night. What the fuck? But like he knows, Christopher Nolan knows that like there's some part of our brain that's just like going through a tunnel will make people just
right.
Believe.
And I think to his credit, that's film hypnosis.
Exactly.
Yeah, he knows.
Yeah. But I agree. It's basically hypnosis.
You said the phrase you used was plausible enough, which I think is all it takes for me to believe almost anything. Like it took me about 15 years to think about Jurassic Park with some degree of skepticism. Because when I'm 9 and it's coming out, even at 9 I'm like, dinosaurs, yeah, right. And then someone in a suit is like, no, we took blood from a mosquito from the past and put it in a frog. I'm like, well, yeah, that checks out. That's how we could do it today.
I felt so strongly that I was like, why don't they do that? I don't understand. What's the holdup, man? And that's also, I think, an interesting linked part of the equation because we talked about like people on the stand and people talking to a police officer while they're looking at like a photo board. Authority seems to be, and there's a lot of studies about that I'd love to hear your take on, Peter, but how true is it? Basically, like my basic skim knowledge of psychology is that anyone will do anything if you're wearing a lab coat. Like that test where they have you shock someone in the other room, and if you're like in street clothes, most people eventually go, I'm not going to shock the person. And if you're the same guy in a lab coat, they'll be like, I'm sorry, sir, yes. Are they dead yet?
I think one of the difficulties nowadays is that we actually have human subjects ethics. So we cannot do that experiment again, at least not in the United States.
Like, yeah, that does maybe, suck.
Maybe in... I think the Germans could do it, but they don't have the same... I'm being serious about that. But
really?
Europe's much more relaxed about all this stuff than the U.S. is.
Is it globally, is it college kids by and large? Because I've heard a very valid point, which is like most psychology studies are only true of a population that self-selected to be in a psychology study.
It is actually a reasonable critique of a lot of the behavioral sciences. So I think there's a term for it. It's like, they call it weird. It's like white, educated, something, right. Something, somethings, you know, which are basically like you. and so you get a skewed perspective because it removes... It can remove cultural elements and things like intelligence and education and so on that certainly move the needle in ways that interact with these manipulations. But back to the Milgram experiment, there's problems with that experiment, obviously. Like, there's problems with plausibility. You know, there's problems because the experimenter was an active participant in the study, so he knew the hypotheses, and so that affects his behavior and also the interpretations of this stuff. And we'll never exactly know how far you can push people in this way, but one thing is very clear, there's lots and lots of work that show that people in positions of authority, even if it's just designated by a costume, does have an influence on how people behave that we do tend to follow. And if you think about it, you're raised to do that. Obey your teachers, obey this, you know. And so we're really just following a script that we learned really early on.
Does everybody know the Milgram experiment? It's the one where...
Six people said yes, so let's...
Yeah, so we can move on.
Let's get a yes, no from each person. We're going to start lower rank.
But yeah, it's the one where a actor in a lab coat tells a person on one side of a one-way mirror to press a button that shocks a person on the other side of the one-way mirror who's also an actor. But I, pressing the button, don't know that these people are actors. And they keep upping the charge. This was done immediately after World War II. During the Nuremberg trials, trying to explain like why Nazis happened. And they found that the people would keep going until it went up to, I think, 450 volts or something. And the actor on the other side was like going, ah, my heart, and then I'm not a good actor. And
Jesus, I was so worried for a second. I was like, listen to him, get him.
And then, like, passing out and, like, convulsing, and they would keep pressing it because the scientist was telling them to. But they just published a book that basically looked at all the methodology, and, like, he said 60% of the people went all the way, but it was, like, 60% of a small subset of 100 other people. So he was, like, really cooking the data. Other things they were doing, like, they changed the wording to be, like, look, man, we're going to, like, lose all our funding if you don't keep going with this.
Right.
Like, yeah. Basically.
Really digging for that thesis.
Right.
So this book, essentially, you're bringing this up to say that the book disproves the Milgram experiment, that it's not, that we won't listen to authority, because I want you to say yes so I could call bullshit on that with a counter story. But
you need his permission because he's the authority figure.
No, and they've actually... They've actually replicated it, but just to a lesser degree, and it's not like 60%, it's like 35%, and they only went up to 150 volts because in 1973 they passed a law saying you couldn't do that sort of...
You couldn't thing. Pretend?
Oh, the shittiest thing that the Milgram experiment did is they never told the people afterwards.
Even after?
One of the
there's
people
like no candid camera like breakdown moment.
One of the people who was involved in it said that they checked the death notices in the newspaper for 2 weeks afterwards looking to see if they had taken part in somebody's
God.
Death.
So before you go into your story, so I think like you can argue about volts and percentages and so on.
Yes!
But I mean... You know, that experiment it's certainly a powerful experiment because it's designed to answer a really big question, which is, how is it that regular, everyday people can participate in a mass murder? And now, of course, what the German people were going through, there was considerable pressure on them. to behave. And also what they were doing was much more timid compared to that, right? They're operating trains and they're, you know what I mean? Or they're just doing nothing in a sense. Right.
And they're propagandistic icons of authority, like everywhere. I feel like the Nazi regime knew very well that, yeah, having constant pervasive authority, you know, is certainly a way to get people to fall in line.
And also killing people who don't cooperate. Yeah. That's also a great way to get people to, if you have to choose.
Or driving them from the country, you eventually just have your boys.
Yeah, yeah, they should redo that experiment and just instead of having a white coat, just a machine gun.
Yeah.
Well, what's weird is they looked into it 10 years later, and actually the guy that they shocked over and over became a Nazi. Just so much hate built up within him.
Three exotic bras and I got them soaking panties. Told them they were certified. Welcome to the Zanny family. Whoa, whoa. Welcome to the family, baby. Whoa, whoa. Three exotic bras and I got them soaking panties. Told them they were certified. Welcome to the Zanny family. Whoa, whoa.
Hey guys, we are listening to Zanny Family, which is a song about the benzodiazepine family of drugs, which includes Xanax and Valium, drugs that have a calming effect. That's one thing that we didn't really touch on, but a lot of the psychoactive drugs that psychiatrists prescribe are behaving in really strange ways in clinical trials of late. Like, for instance, there's the study Jason Pargin and I talked about a few months ago that says that antidepressants are becoming less effective in treating depression, and we just don't know why. Anyway, Zanny Family by Future doesn't make me think of any of that. It's a pretty stupid song, actually. But as with any psychoactive drug, it's pretty addictive, and good luck getting it out of your head for the next few hours. Hope you enjoy it, and these words from our sponsors.
I was just trying to slide on the side to hit the side, though. You get penalized, you come around, it ain't enough, though. Keep a bag of Zannies if you're trying to join the family. Got the sauce on me and it's off-white candy. Puerto Rican freaking.
This episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by The Books. That's B-O-U-Q-S. Guys, let's cut to the chase. You know you want to be a better guy to those special people in your life. Your mom, your significant other, your boss, that's a hint to all my employees at Cracked. And there's no better way to do that than by manning up or womaning up for my female employees and buying that special someone an amazing bouquet of flowers from Books.com. Prices start at just $40. You're not swindled by hidden fees and upcharges. Plus, when you register with Books, you'll get free weekday shipping. So here's the deal. Listeners can now get $15 off any bouquet at Books.com/cracked and by using the code cracked at checkout. And remember, you'll get free weekday shipping too. So get something nice for that special someone this Christmas or, you know, just because they're an amazing boss. That's BOUQS.com/cracked and enter cracked at checkout. This episode of the Cracked Podcast is sponsored by Movement Watches. So now that we're a solid 72 hours past the Black Friday madness, your will to live and your will to shop have probably been completely drained by the Christmas industrial complex. But I have a simple recommendation that will melt away all your gift-giving anxiety with just a few clicks. Movement watches are slick and amazingly designed, like those ones that you would buy at the department stores, but they start at just $95. And they're sold online, so you don't have to deal with all the crazy crowds that have no doubt taken over your local malls by now. So check these watches out at mvmtwatches.com/cracked. If you add that slash cracked at the end there of the URL, you'll get free shipping and 15% off your purchase. They make an amazing gift for anyone in your family, mom, dad, brother, sister. Once again, that's mvmtwatches.com/cracked for free shipping and 15% off an amazing Christmas gift.
I dip it in the blunt, I'm trying to smoke the mud. I load it up,
my gun, try to smoke the plug. When I get done waving his hammer, I'm gon' soak you up. I got trophies, I got no shit, got a way bigger buzz. I get loaded.
So this is a thing I've been sitting on for a while, and I don't know what to do with it. It's one of the least responsible and ethical things that my middle school back in New Jersey has ever done.
Oh my God.
I'll tell it as quickly as I can. It was a school that was 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, those 3 years, and the way the curriculum lined up, we were all learning about the Holocaust at the same time.
Oh, my God.
Different levels of it. Different, like, 6th grade, here's your version of the curriculum, 7th grade, 8th grade, et cetera. The administration decided that one day they would pick a minority of students and make them wear green badges and call them greenies and actively encouraged anyone who wasn't a greenie to be mean to and exclude the greenies.
You were a greenie.
I was a greenie.
Yeah.
Because the story can't be, I wasn't a greenie, I was a Nazi and I loved it. Like, that's a bad story. It can't be that. The principal, I suppose, called my parents the night before, and they're like, look, we picked your son. He's going to be one of the greenies. And my parents are like, oh, I got a call about one of my kids that wasn't. He did something bad. Yeah, call him whatever you want. Do anything. It's fine. So I wore a green badge for a day, and we were forced to sit together. All the greenies were stuck together in classes and at lunch, and people, like, students were throwing forks and food at greenies and like, get out of here, greenies! I mean, no.
It's not your
fault,
Daniel.
Thank you.
Jack, I asked if any filthy greenies were going to be on the panel, and you told me no.
And I don't understand why this experiment was conducted, because you're not going to learn anything when you tell a 13-year-old who's like furiously horny and doesn't know what to do with his body, hey, just for today, you could be mean to anyone who's got this thing. And they're going to learn, that feels good. And the rest of us, like, the next day, it was like, all right, what did everyone learn? It's like, yeah, on behalf of the greenies, I think it would have been tough being Jewish during the Holocaust. I already thought that. But thanks for teaching me that. My friend Joe, whom I used to play basketball with, is like a green sticker away from throwing knives at me.
And was Joe like, actually, my position softened a little now that I've
right,
been
Joe,
on the conquering side.
Right, Joe was like, you know, the Holocaust was terrible, but it seems like it would have been easier to have been a Nazi, is what Joe learned. And now Joe is a lawyer in real life, by the way.
He was only following orders.
Anyway, so what do I do with that information?
Actually, don't talk about it. So, I mean, I say that tongue-in-cheek, but actually, you know, one of the things that this comes up in movies all the time is, you know, in Good Will Hunting and all these, you know, any sort of drama that involves a psychiatrist or a therapist is you have to talk through your childhood problems and get it out and work it through. You know, really the best thing you can do is move on from it. Revisiting these things and going back and looking at them constantly, it just continues to upset you and cause these kinds of problems. Like, one of the best coping mechanisms is to say, oh, things have changed. That was me when I was a kid. I've moved on. And, like, there's this idea of talking through all these things.
I ain't no greenie no more.
That's actually, I mean, we had a lot of fun here today. That's a true thing, because that is so pervasive in movies that there's always, every movie and TV show, psychiatrist or therapist is like, get down into your family, figure out what thing happened when you were a child. What's your rosebud sled? Or it's about your mom, confront your mom with this childhood thing, and you're saying,
well,
movies lied to me?
I should be careful, because I only have 1% of Fraser's training.
You're basically Niles, then.
But, well, I guess
burn.
Well, I'm basing this off a little bit of knowledge that I have, which, you know, is dangerous. But I'm basing a lot of this off of work on what's called affect regulation. So just how do people cope with bad circumstances in their life, bad situations, negative emotions. And usually, like, focusing a lot on the cause of those negative emotions is not a great way to deal with negative emotions. There's lots of other great ways to do it. And so in that way, I'm making a case for why.
Yeah, one that I really definitely wanted to get to that I believed was true just because it seemed so plausible. Then I recently heard the reverse, and I'm like, that seems equally plausible, so now I'm opposed, is the idea of bottling up emotions and then releasing them as if they're like a gas, like a very common thing, at least that I heard many times growing up, was like punch, if you're angry, like punch a pillow.
Yeah.
And then I was like, that seems to make sense. You exhaust yourself in a harmless way. And then a couple years ago, someone pointed out, well, actually, you sort of get in the habit of doing the things you routinely do, so setting aside time to actively focus on your anger is likely to make you sort of addicted to having sessions of anger. I was like, that also sounds true. What do I punch, Peter?
Right, the release feels good, right? So,
right, yeah. So is the release of a negative emotion building that program and that habit, or is the idea of emotional catharsis and release a real thing?
Wow, that's a hard one.
So, did you know when you came on this podcast that you're going to help us work through all of our shit?
I think it's about time. Let's get my dad out here, actually. We got some shit to work out.
So certainly trying to suppress negative emotions backfires, right? So the more you try not to be angry, the more angry that it tends to, you know, make you in that way. And then certainly acting on anger is not a great way to deal with anger, right? Because, you know, because usually what you're doing is the things that anger make you do are not always healthy, right? In that
I'm so mad I'm going to build a house for the poor. That's not a situation. You're right. It's always exactly. It's punching a pillow or something similar. You're right.
What I think the average person doesn't realize but does oftentimes is they have a whole menu of things that you can do to deal with, let's say, anger, right, in this way. Or, you know, it could be anxiety or it could be depression, right? So anger, anxiety, depression, those are the big three negative emotions that we deal with day in and day out. And everybody sort of has one or another that kind of is more their issue, you know, in that sense. And so there's things like reappraising the thing that, the situation that made you angry. So if it's here in L.A., it's driving. Is it then taking a perspective, a more kind perspective, on the person who just cut you off, right? So that's one way to you alleviate the thing that has made you unhappy. Is it distraction? Or is it that you do something enjoyable? So there's actually a whole bunch of different things that you can do when faced with negative emotions that are learned, you know, that you might not even realize that you're doing it, right? So anybody who's been dealing with a tough project in school or work goes on crack.com.
That was meant to be an applause break. No, it's fine. It's fine. We'll add it in post. It's too late. We'll add it in post. It's fine.
Right, or Trump gets elected, you buy a podcast ticket.
Yes. Wait, right. These are coping mechanisms, and right, and so that's a way to distract yourself to create positive emotion and so on. But yeah, punching the pillow probably not. But meditation is actually a really great way to kind of, because it basically removes thoughts from your mind.
Probably after you get where you're driving, right? You don't want to like just right. Go directly into the meditation. Yeah, there's sort of a hydraulic way that people like think about like urges in movies. Like any homophobic person is secretly repressing their own homosexuality, like in American Beauty, or punching a pillow, or the movie equivalent where you like fire off 8 shots over the bad guy's head, yeah. And then the you're like,
point
you're
blank,
under arrest,
right?
Son of a bitch. Yeah, but I guess I just don't feel like emotions work like pee. Like you like build them up and then have to let them go and... Yeah, they don't, right?
No. Well, I mean, so one of the things is nothing seems as important as it is while you're thinking about it, right? So while you're thinking about something, that seems like the most important thing in the world. So one of the best coping mechanisms is just to think about something else. We do this all the time, whether it be on purpose or, you know, it's this natural automatic kind of thing. Because emotions are connected to things. Right, so what ends up happening is there's an event, there's a situation that creates a negative emotion, and then that thing goes away, and then the question becomes, does this negative emotion become a mood, right, where it's more diffuse and it's not connected, I think. And you're like, why am I so pissed off today? You know, and so it's because something happened at one point, and now you don't associate it anymore. The nice thing is if you're able to kind of deal with that in the moment and then go on and have positive emotions from that, positive mood, that thankfully is the norm. We normally walk around in a very mildly positive mood, even in LA, I think, right?
That was super comforting to me because it seems like you're describing things in my brain as having like a coherent connection to actual external circumstances. And something else I've thought about psychology often is, for example, like if I'm in a bad mood and I snap at someone, it could be about something, but then there are many times where in retrospect I'll realize it was about like, or could easily have been about, my blood sugar had dipped, which makes you feel a certain way, and if I had an apple, I wouldn't have snapped. So I'm just wondering how, if you have any fix on, or even like, don't want to speak for all psychologists, but have your own take on, how much of my emotion is justified versus just like a fabrication of my brain chemicals as they vary naturally throughout the day. Or at least as a psychologist, how do you tackle that line of like, I'm so mad about that thing. Well, are you really? Or do you not like the lighting in here right now or whatever?
Yeah. So, well, okay. So
yeah, same question.
Yeah, got it. And you too? All right. Well, you're different than those two. Definitely. No, so I think the way to think about it is you have to exert some self-control over your emotions. At least there'd be murders all the time if we didn't, right? Like in this way that you have to, that there, this is something that we have some control over. And so there are certainly circumstances, like you said, being tired, you know, that make it harder to actually manage your emotions. Like it takes a level of willpower. It takes some impulse control in order to be able to do those kinds of things. And so, yeah, you're right. Like you're not always going to do it well. And that's kind of okay.
It's almost as if, like, the control over your emotions is an additional attribute modulating the emotions.
Yeah, same conclusion.
So basically you're asking, like, if free will exists, essentially?
Yeah, that's where I'm trying to lead the conversation. I don't know if it's possible because I know, like, you're not a neurobiologist.
Let's debunk that myth.
My next question would be, well, then what is willpower? Is that quantifiable as, like, electrical impulses? But that's a different expert, different podcast.
So, Kitty Genovese.
Oh, that'll perk the podcast right up.
Yeah.
Yes, multiple stabbing victim, Kitty Genovese. Genovese? Genovese.
Do we have a clip?
I have no idea how to pronounce it. No, it does seem like all of the most iconic psychology stories have been debunked.
Well, two synopses, just in case, real quick. Poor woman named Kitty Genovese or Genovese stabbed outside her apartment building. The legend of the case study, and that's what I don't even know if it's actually accurate, is that many people witnessed the stabbing from their windows. No one called the police. And I believe the thesis they gathered, or maybe they gathered multiple things from that, but the idea that became popular, at least in pop culture, there was a song about it called Small Circle of Friends, which is quite good.
Was the short version?
Yeah, it's pretty short. Which is that if everyone thought someone else would call the police, right? And there's this diffusion effect of if you live in a society, especially society where you literally see other people around you, you're like, well, society will take care of it. And that we're all monsters, I guess, was the that was the jab of that study. True. What?
And that's been debunked, or
well,
is the
so
jury still, what
I've heard controversy about it on both sides.
Right. The debunking story that I read was like, some people did call the cops, and others yelled at the attacker out the window. I was like, that's not enough. That doesn't make me feel better.
You better stop.
Hey, leave her alone.
He didn't do it. He's still doing it.
Something's on TV.
Get out of here, you greenie.
It seems like it's a true effect. I think they've proven that this actually happens in laboratory settings, and the story was just an exaggerated story. Essentially.
Yeah, so I think what often happens, you know, psychologists are normal people most of the time. And so, you know, they're searching for ideas. They notice things in the world and they say, "Oh, that's something I should study that. Why does that happen?" So the Kitty Genovese story is sort of, you know, in the same way the banality of evil, you know, the Nazis led to Milgram. The Kitty Genovese story led to a whole series of studies about diffusion of responsibility. And how this notion of the more people who are present in a time of crisis, in a moment of crisis, the less the likelihood that any one person will step up. So basically, if you have a heart attack, the best situation to be in is to have one person there because the person has to do something about it. As you start adding people, then the likelihood that any one person's going to act goes down. In that way.
I'd love to see the one instance where they just had two and they're like, you do it. You take care of me. I don't want to do it.
Yeah. You know, and so that's why, like, for instance, if you've ever taken a first aid class, one of the things that you're told is to say, you call 911, you do this thing, instead of, yeah.
I did feel like I should. Wow, that really works.
It's good acting.
Instead of someone call 911, right, in that kind of sense. But, you know, the work is actually pretty solid, I think, psychological research that shows how the influence of others actually sort of act on people in a counterintuitive way.
It was another cruel study where, like, they had a bunch of different people on basically like a phone line, and then one person pretended like they were having a stroke, and the more people that were on the phone line, the less likely they were to be like, I'm gonna go do something about this. But again, it's like so traumatic to everybody involved in that study.
Also, like, that just, I don't want to discount science, but it seems really hard to learn anything if the study is, hey, college student, we're going to pay you $50 to do a study. Okay, what is it? I can't tell you. Just get on this phone, and you're on a phone with 9 people, and one of them is having a stroke. I don't know, I'm 19 years old, and I'm getting $50 to do this study, and someone's having a stroke, and I know nothing is real. Like, it's
more like $5.
Oh, my goodness gracious. But, like, how much can we learn from these studies if we are telling people that it is a study?
I mean, they always make up a fake reason, right? Don't they usually say, like, okay, we're studying this thing, and then while they're studying that, someone has a stroke. But yeah, I agree.
But like, I agree. I would want to see exit polls as you come out where it's now did you believe that the guy was having a stroke or not? But then people would lie because they're like, well, I didn't help, so no, I didn't believe.
Yeah. So as the science representative here, I'll try to address this. So what good science does, first of all, I agree with you. If it was just that study, then I would say that doesn't tell us very much. So the best science does, I think, the following things, is that it takes what we already know about human behavior and then builds a theory about why it is the case that this, for instance, diffusion of responsibility will occur, and then not only shows it in that laboratory study but across a bunch of other ones. Now, you can critique those studies because they're really artificial, there's deception involved in them, you're worried about, you know, social desirability, so people not really telling you that they knew it was fake or, you know, whatever it may be. But then you're also looking for evidence in the real world that's consistent with that. So, you know, how many people have driven past a car where someone has a flat tire and thinking, well, someone else will help with that kind of a thing. But on a country road, would stop, right? You know, for those same kind of reasons. And so what we are trying to do is build a strong case both with theory, keeping things that are consistent with intuition where possible, and then building strong evidence, both real world and laboratory, in order to kind of feel like we're right enough about this in order to move on to something else.
And hopefully. Generally it's real world observations come first. You see something and you think it's a theory, and then you test it based on...
You know, well, I think it depends on the type of science, you know, so...
No, just tell me about all science.
So physics is all theory based, you know, but... I don't know. I've done both. I've done both where I've kind of noticed something in the world and say, you know, like, that's strange, that's peculiar. But then I've also used theories to make new predictions. I actually find the stuff that comes out of theory sort of more exciting because it's like, well, if this is true, this should happen in the real world. And then you look into the real world and find it. That's kind of cool. But I think mostly it's folks who just sort of know humans really well. Just going, wait, that's weird. I wish it was more exciting than that, but that's really like a lot.
It's exciting in the way of how normal it is and how accessible it is, because for a while you assume that science is people get together in a room and they decide this is how the world is. But it's very interesting to me that someone was like, oh, that guy's baby looks like the father. Someone was like, yeah, I mean, biologically they have to, because if it didn't, the father would like eat the kid or whatever. And then a few years later, someone was like, after decades of, that makes sense to me, someone does a study and is like, no, that's bullshit, that's insane. And the initial person is like, oh, damn, yeah, makes sense. A thought I had, but sure.
There's actually a third place that this happens, is you read someone else's paper and you go, that's crap, right? You're like, that's wrong. And then you run the study to try to show that that's the case. But I mean, you know, like, so what, there was something that came out recently about why people look like their dogs. right? Did someone, does it sound, does it sound familiar
to
anyone?
And it's gotta be something that's in the imagination of the viewer, right? It can't be like a physical effect.
I wanna say,
what was the conclusion?
If you read that on our site, it's bullshit.
Okay. I think that's, that study comes from like people going to the dog park and like, you know, Jerry looks like his dog and Jane looks like her dog. Like, why is that kind of a thing? And like, you know, is it like, I mean, it has to do with...
Tell us, what did they find out?
I think I know the answer to it. I can tell you how you go about trying to find that out. So, for instance, you give them pictures of dogs and say, which of these dogs would you choose? And then you show pictures of the people and the dogs to other folks and rate how similar they are to find out, like, for instance, are they drawn to dogs that look like them? And what is it about the looks that are the same? And I think it has to do with the eyes.
Like the eye to
someone Google
ratio.
That. I'm not sure that's true, but that's my vague recollection.
That's what
of
I
it
love
all.
About these studies, too, is psychology is so rooted in the real world that the studies will involve whatever. Like, as I mean, when we go out to make videos, we're often doing something new that we haven't done before. Like, we're going to roll down a sand dune in a barrel. We haven't done that. We have to figure it out. And like, there will be psychology.
You guys remember
studies.
That video, right? That
it's coming out. I'm,
after
I'm
hours,
building
we roll
buzz.
Down a sand dune in a barrel.
Niagara Falls is too expensive. But where the fuck was I going with this now? You completely derailed.
You were happy that that these kind of experiments involve bullshit.
Oh yeah, no, I was just gonna talk about the one. Like, there's one, I know we know stuff about mothers being able to identify their baby by the cry amongst other babies crying. So that either involved, like, gathering footage of babies crying or something. And there's the one where it's, like, a series of people sniff the underarms of worn shirts and try to identify which one is their significant other. So I just love that psychology experiments could literally be, like, you take the $5, you walk in, and they're like, start smashing these grapes with that hammer. Yeah. Why? It doesn't matter. We're going to know something.
You really like the idea of a probably stoned 20-year-old walking into a room for $5, and they're like, which one of these dogs looks like which one of these people? And they're just like, fuck it, these two.
Well, see, I love, because I was a poor student, and I'd be like, this I can do. This...
You say it's probably stoned, but like, I really do feel like that is a hidden bias in the experiments, because it's not just that they're college students, it's that they're college students who are bored enough to be like, yeah, I want to do this. And like, somebody actually came out from the Stanford prison experiment, which we haven't talked about yet, but is total bullshit.
Hold on, Jack, did we just get a woo from the audience?
Yeah, the Stanford prison experiment.
On the
Stanford
experiment. Prison. That one proved at least to pop culture that man can be made into a hateful war machine.
What, one of the very guards popular. Came out later and was like, first of all, the guy who organized it was like stage directing us the whole time. He was like, so what we're going to want to do is just think about it as you're all powerful and they're weak. And like, that was the guy running the experiment. So like, they knew exactly what he wanted them to do. But the guy who like wrote about it 20 years later was like, and I was stoned the whole time. I like brought joints in, gave them to the prisoners. And so like, everybody was just baked.
This is why my job is so difficult.
Right. Colorado Boulder.
Wait, because you're stoned all the time?
We have not debunked that many psychology things.
Well, I had also heard about the Stanford one that it was like, again, people knew going in that they were signing up to be in a play-acting scenario for several weeks. So they had to give them a little detail, because they knew it would take a while. So they told them, you're going to be playing a prison guard. So you're automatically getting people who are like, that sounds fun to do for 2 weeks of my college experience, play a prison guard.
Well, I would say I find myself defending science over here, but I'll do it again. So, but no.
I mean, I feel the same way. This table is the science table. We're under attack tonight.
So I don't know the specifics of how they created this thing, but one of the foundational ideas, if you want to establish causality, is the notion of you have to randomly assign subjects to different treatment conditions, right? So the classic is in tests of new drugs, right? You have a placebo or a control condition, and then you have the treatment condition. And that has to be random, right? Because if it's not random, then there might be some other variable that you can attribute the success or failure of the study to it. So in the case of the Stanford prison experiment, there should have been random assignment to at least whether you're a guard or you're an
inmate. And I think there was.
In that way. Now, there might be lots of other problems, and I think what you guys are highlighting with these sort of classic, well-known studies still exists today in academia, I mean, in science in general, and that is that there's a lot of pressure to publish. There's a lot of pressure to be right. And so what ends up happening is people end up, I think, cutting corners or, you know, trimming some data and doing all this kind of thing, which just muddies the whole entire process. And then when this stuff comes out, it undermines a lot of work that might actually be really good, might actually be theoretically very solid, and might actually hold up.
Because of that, there's an incentive to capture the imagination, right? So if you're sitting on numbers that could imply anyone around you could be turned into a Nazi in 2 weeks, that's juicy. Like, that's a juicy study.
Yeah, and it makes it into pop culture in a way that the sort of boring memory studies, you know, the non-Elizabeth Loftus studies don't make it into pop culture. I mean, the big thing is anything that's sort of counterintuitive, as a scientist, the standards of evidence have to go up even higher in that way. If it goes against common sense, if it goes against what the experts believe to be true, then those are the studies that are most susceptible to unethical behavior and the kind of puffery that happens.
Because sites like us will write about it, because that's literally a thing we talk about in our editorial meeting. We're like, well, that's not surprising. And like,
I know,
but we don't do really any psychology experiments that much anymore. We write about the replication crisis instead.
That's right.
Yeah. But the most popular TED Talk, by the way, you have an amazing TED Talk that people should watch.
Which one of us are you talking to?
But the most viewed TED Talk on YouTube is the one about power posing.
Yes, right.
The woman who like says that if you stand like in the Superman pose or the Uberman, or no, it's like
arms akimbo,
right? Arms or hands on your hip, that you will like see this boost in confidence, and like that became like a thing everybody was talking about and writing about. And even as that was happening, there had already been a study of, I think, 5 times as many people as the original study to see if they could replicate it, and there was zero effect.
That was very similar to like when I was growing up. I wonder if anyone else had this experience. If I was really sick, my parents would tell me that like smiling, like looking happy, would make me feel better. And it seemed to work, which could just be a Pavlovian thing, but that's kind of like the power pose. They would be like, look not sick, like act happy.
So that...
And I'm like, where are you getting this from now that I'm an adult? I don't know where they got that information, but...
We have written about the fact that people who get Botox, and this is very counterintuitive, so now I'm very suspicious of it, people who get Botox report being depressed because they can't form their face into facial expressions. And I have always heard that. We think of it as like emotion occurs in the brain, goes out to the face, and like you have a facial expression, but it's more of a two-way street.
That's true.
That is true.
Well, I think like the power posing stuff is, so obviously the potential benefits have made its way into pop culture, but even the debate, like, so this is, I go to these conferences and you get a few drinks into people and then they tell you what they really think about stuff. And, you know, the power posing work is really controversial in part because the author of the work has gotten rich promoting it. But it's hard research to do because you know you're doing a power pose. Like, you know you're standing like this. And if you believe that standing like this makes you more confident, then guess what? It does, right? So the question is not whether power posing makes people feel more confident, because it certainly seems to do it, but does it do all these other things like help with cortisol and do, you know, like there's some like biological type stuff that has been debated and so on in this way. And so then the question becomes, what are the limits of the claims that scientists should make prescriptively, right? So if you want to live a better life, you should smile more, because smiling more makes you actually happier, because you have an association, because when you're happy, you smile. And then when you smile, your brain goes, oh, I'm happy. And
yeah, so, or I believe we talked about in an earlier episode, Ben Franklin would ask a favor of someone who he wanted to like him.
Yeah, that
like,
was his...
Rather than doing a favor for someone, he would use his status to say, look, I know you don't like me, but I really need this favor. If you can help me out, you'd be in my debt. Some minor thing he knew they would do. And he found that they would eventually justify to themselves that they must like him, or why would they have done it?
Yeah. Right. Self-perception theory is what it's called. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan concurs.
You drank one beer, man.
Yeah, I feel like the power posing thing is one of those things that it's almost like a prank on people because you look so stupid when you're doing it. And they're like, this is the magical cure to modern life. And
or I don't see what's like different that. Than like meditation in a particular pose.
Right.
You know, it's just the idea of do this thing every day that you associate with a better life and it eventually is a cycle.
Yeah, well, the question is often how big is the effect, right? So what scientists are generally interested in is can we detect an effect? So is the hypothesis that we've derived from this theory correct? And so if you find a tiny but significant change statistically, you go, all right. But just because that tiny change occurs in a laboratory, for instance, doesn't mean that it's going to help you nail your Toastmaster speech. You need bigger effects oftentimes in the real world, and then what ends up happening is a scientist, including myself, might write a book and say, oh, you should do this or you should do that, and sometimes it's a big leap between the lab and real life.
Also, everybody knows the power pose thing now, so if you go up and do your best man toast and like stand like that for a while, I feel like you would get self-conscious. All right, we have not debunked that many myths, and we've got 15 minutes left, so we're going to do a lightning round. You just say myth or not.
Big we plus. Asked you to bring a gong and a bell. Did you bring those?
Five stages of grief?
No.
Yeah.
There's way more stages, is that right?
They happen all at the same time sometimes, you know,
right.
The whole thing.
They don't happen in order, and also the original study was by a woman describing people accepting their own death, but somehow it got transposed over to people like
any
getting
grief,
through.
Like any trauma,
right,
the death
exactly.
of a loved one, yeah. Your dog doesn't look as much like you as you would have liked. See, if I was in the dog one, that's when I'd be like, this isn't the real study, right? Someone's going to have a stroke. One of these dogs is going to have a stroke. And I am not going to help.
Yeah, I've just been sitting over here trying to figure out what dogs you guys look like, this whole thing. The Mozart effect, that you play Mozart for children.
Oh, like unborn babies?
Smart. Yeah.
I think the research is pretty clear that the benefits are between 0 and 2, you know, with regard to a whole variety of things. Like, basically, if you can take good care of your kid from 0 to 2, like expose them to lots of things, have them healthy, eat well, it sets them up for at least the potential to have a vibrant life.
But right. Is there actual significance to the idea that Mozart music or complex classical music is somehow like
I will
encouraging the growth of their brain?
Because we've written about that. Okay. And Mozart did improve the children. Blur was better. The band Blur did better. So it's just like any sort of stimulation, basically.
What if I play my kid Limp Bizkit in the womb? What happens then?
You don't want to do that, man.
They stay. They refuse to come out of the world. Can I ask similarly, like the whiplash effect or also the Mozart effect, the idea that I think a lot of people hold that like extreme brutal struggle will cause someone to suddenly like leap to the talent level of an idiot savant or something in whatever craft they're in. And it seems to me that like children who were nourished and felt safe would have the most mental development.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. There you go. Stop.
Abusing,
I know you're all out there abusing your kids hoping for a genius.
Cult members are stupid, gullible sheep.
What do you think?
As a representative of the science table, I think sheep and people are like a totally different thing. So,
correct. That is right.
So I don't know much about this, but a little bit of work that shows that cult members actually tend to be more intelligent, at least more educated than average. So there's something else going on there.
This is sheer intuition, or like agreeing with an intuition thing I've heard. As far as I know, there's not studies to back it up. But I think a theory that compelled me was like, the more intelligent you are, you'd think that means the better you are at seeing truth, but the reality is that the more able you are to build any kind of structure that you want to defend the beliefs that you choose to believe.
You're right. There's actually been work on this. It's called motivated reasoning. So this is actually, for me, as a psychologist, one of the most fascinating things is that if you want something to be, if you believe something, you're incredibly good at attacking ideas that go against it and very good at making reasons for why this is the case. And more intelligent people are better at motivated reasoning And so they actually are harder to persuade with actual, sometimes, facts and so on when they have a belief that they already exist. So you nailed that. Have you thought about joining a PhD program?
Do you want to join the
science
table? Should
I swap tables?
Yeah.
Jack on his island of mysticism. And
subliminal messages, like in Fight Club when he like has the single frame of a dick. The kids start crying.
Like how in our show, how we always cut in the sound of a dick very briefly.
Right.
I need to pause again briefly because in the same way that you said Stanford Prison Experiment and someone went, woo, as soon as you said single frame of dick, someone in the audience went, nah. Is that what we should have just been doing the whole time?
And you think people and sheep are different. I think that was a very branch sound.
Yeah, no evidence that subliminal messaging works. Actually, the scary thing is not the subliminal stuff. It's the what they call supraliminal stuff. It's actually the stuff around us all the time, the Nike swooshes and all the advertising and all that kind of stuff. That stuff does work. Seeing a Nike swoosh over and over again actually makes you like Nike more. But people don't think that's the thing that's the problem. They think that it's the frames that are being cut into movies.
Yeah, it's the stuff you can actually see.
It is,
not the thing that the
that's
message
so
that's backwards in the heavy metal lyrics or whatever.
That's not just used in Fight Club. I mean, I know stories of governments, you know, trying to use subliminal messaging to accomplish all sorts of things. And if it's just not a thing, that's so funny. What
not
was
a
the
thing.
Effort?
The government is very stupid.
I certainly remember when I worked at a movie theater when I was 15 years old, that someone was saying, this giant Pepsi vending machine has a subliminal message. There's like, one of the ice cubes is subtly shaped like a cow, because like the eye catches it and cows make people happy. And that'll inspire you to buy more Pepsi. And I was like, that sounds right, as I'm staring at this giant red, white, and blue Pepsi machine. I was like, it's probably because there's a cow tricking me.
Man, the logic of that was just insane. New Jersey's a crazy place. Electroshock.
Hold on, myth? Is that a myth? Can you say it's a myth?
I actually am from New Jersey, and it is a crazy place.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
So that's the Jersey table.
We're going to cut all that out. New Jersey's great. It's the Garden State.
Electroshock treatment is a savage, primitive treatment.
It sounds that way, but I'm not so much.
It's actually like still used. And having seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I was like, why would you do that to somebody? And like, doesn't it like just make him like into a vegetable? Yeah. He like gets shocked.
No, from the movie anyway, the shocking doesn't do anything to him, but they do like a lobotomy to him. That's what turns him to
Yeah, that's
to a
also
vegetable.
Harmless. That,
yeah.
Well, we only use 10% of our brain, so you can dig a lot out of it.
Oh my God. That is the one that gets me the most.
Yeah.
This notion that...
Gets us the most.
Oh, yeah, this side.
Is it even true that... Because then I reasoned, oh, well, maybe they meant you only use roughly 10% at a time is lit up, like if you were in an MRI all the time.
Yeah.
Is that even anything? Where did this come from? Do you have any idea?
You know, I don't remember exactly. I don't know. This is the problem
it
with all these
things. It
could
be purely a movie. Like, it could have been from some pop culture thing, I guess.
That was the explanation we gave on our article was, that it's like only 10% lit up at a time. So saying that is like saying you only use 10% of a keyboard at the same time. It's like, well, that's what they're, right. what it's designed for. It has different regions.
Is the 10%, is it even close to anything? 10%, you use 10% of your brain at a time.
I mean, I'm sure something. I don't know off the top of my head, to be honest. Like, but this idea that your brain lights up, first of all, that's all bullshit. The notion that a brain lights up. No, this is just a picture of blood flow in particular areas that are being highlighted. And so when they say it lights up, it just means that part of the brain is being used and thus being fed more. And that's what's being measured in that way. And so these pictures are like the lighting up is just, we know that there's activity in this area at this moment in time.
There's not a little lightning storm.
Right,
going
my
on
image
my brain.
Of a brain, though, has always been that a synapse is a gap that has little lightning bolts going across it. Is that total bullshit?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
Also, my brain just feels like super hot all the time. Is that normal?
It's the
you
hat.
Are wearing a wool beanie. Yeah.
That was an experiment that got pitched to us this week about the Atlantic salmon that they put under the fMRI machine. Do you know about this?
No, I haven't heard
Cooked
this.
It right up, delicious.
No, but it was like an experiment to look at people's brains to see how it registered
pictures of different emotions. And then they did the same thing with an Atlantic salmon, dead. They don't do very well under fMRI machines.
You have to stay still in the,
right,
in the machine.
And they also saw like activity that was consistent with what they would have expected to see. Like there were like parts of the salmon brain lighting up. They were just like, so this is all bullshit. Yeah, the dead salmon. So like fMRI machines are like really open to interpretation, and it's like they basically did it to illustrate that like all those studies of like brain scans, like we think of them as being, you know, it's
totally
like
objective.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Like a number, like, oh, quadrant four of the brain was at 86%. So, but it's really interpretive is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It really bummed me out.
That is sad, yeah.
It was like, it was a really bad week for the soft
sciences.
We were
talking about eyewitness testimony, and I've seen several great documentaries recently that like shake my faith in DNA evidence being where it needs to be to be trusted. We know fingerprint evidence is not as good as you think. And then at the end of the day, you're like, I really feel like it's still based on, I don't like that guy. I think
he
did it.
Okay, so let me...
It seems like there's no real evidence in the world.
Yeah, I mean, this
is... Did that fish kill that guy or what?
So I'd like to try to end on a little bit more of a positive note if we can. Only because, you know, obviously we're talking about debunking myths and so on in this way, but I do think that this, actually, this kind of thing is actually a very healthy thing to do, even if you're using a salmon to question fMRI.
It does feel like a dig in the form of a study.
I'm kind of impressed by it, actually. But what ends up happening is the kind of classic two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. And when you look at how far we've come as a society due to science, we can make a pretty good case for science, right? So whether it be vaccinations or understanding, you know, depression and, you know, and a lot of the things that, or even, you know, this, actually, I think this, the notion about the work that's being done with eyewitness testimony, it's sort of upsetting to think that we're not as good at this thing and that we have systems of justice built around it. But if done well, eventually it'll make our lives better, right? Safer and more efficient and happier and so on in that kind of way. And so the problem with science is that it's messy and it's slow, but I do believe that eventually, you know, it wins out in that way.
I find it reassuring how easy it is to get away with murder. I think that's good news for me.
This was almost such a positive note.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, everyone.
I've been living without limits. As far as my business, I'm the only one that's in control. I've been.
All right, that was a good time. This is FML by Kanye West, which seems to be a song about having a mental breakdown. And it's rumored Kanye is actually having one of those right now, allegedly. So, first of all, hoping he's okay. But I think that's a big reason why we can't look away from him. His talent got him in the door, but then watching his psyche kind of explode in front of us is a big part of what has made him so famous for so long. One thing I forgot to mention that I'd wanted to was the fact that a lot of psychiatric disorders and just mental states have been found to be contagious between people in the same way that the common cold can be contagious. We'll add in an article about that in the footnotes, but we have something called mirror neurons in our mind that makes it so that when we talk about experiencing someone else's mood vicariously or secondhand embarrassment, you're literally experiencing that in some ways. So anyways, yeah, that's a counterintuitive thing that I had meant to get to that we didn't have time for, but just the really palpable, actually physical way that people can interact with the emotions of those around them. And hoping Kanye is doing all right, like I said, despite his political views. I saw his show before he started talking about Trump, and it really was an incredible work of art, I guess. Speaking of incredible works of art, hope you enjoyed our show. And if you did, you can come to our next live show. We should have a link in the footnotes to the episode. It is going to be December the 10th, and it's going to be a year in review show. We're not sure exactly what we'll be covering, but one thing we know we're going to be covering is all the great news that people didn't cover this year because we were busy talking about how this was the worst year ever. It wasn't a great year. There were some obviously horrible things that happened, but those things are going to get covered in everyone else's year in review. So one thing I promise is we will be covering the good news. Usually we do year in reviews in reviews. So we kind of take stock of how everybody else is reviewing the year and fill in the cracks a little bit. They usually sell out pretty quickly. So get to the page. We'll be linking to it in the footnotes, which we're on to now. We are going to be linking off to Dr. Peter McGraw's page, as well as the video of his TED Talk about how humor works, which is a pretty interesting theory, which actually really works pretty well. We're going to link to a Scientific American article called The Five Fallacies of Grief, which debunks the five stages of grief. We'll be linking to a video of my friend Elizabeth Loftus about how unreliable your memory is. It's called How Reliable Is Your Memory? Spoiler alert, not very is the answer. We're going to be linking off to the video of Darren Brown convincing Simon Pegg that he wants a bicycle using random words. It's really impressive, weird magic trick that I still don't totally believe is actually happening, even though I guess it is. I don't know. We'll link to an article in The Atlantic called Questioning the Milgram Experiment that I read that I was drawing on during our conversation. We'll link off to an article about how contagious mental illness and mental states can be, and New York Magazine article called How the False Story of Kitty Genovese's Murder Went Viral. The Cracked article, Five Ridiculous Lies You Probably Believe About Psychology. Number three is the Stanford Prison Experiment. We'll link to a video called Your Body Language Shapes Who You Are. It's the power posing TED Talk that has been widely debunked. We'll link to a Slate article called The Power of the Power Pose that debunks that video. A The Verge article about the Mozart effect, which is a myth. A Wired article about scanning the dead salmon in the fMRI, highlighting the risk of why brain scans are kind of bullshit. And finally, a Cracked article called Six Mental Illness Myths Hollywood Wants You to Believe. And that's going to do it for this week. Once again, go to the description of this episode for those footnotes, as well as a link to the page where you can buy tickets for our upcoming live show. And that'll do it. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien. And we'll be back next week with more podcast. Talk to you guys then. Only I can mention it. See, before I let you go, one last thing I need to let you know. You ain't never seen nothing crazy then. This nigga when he off his Lexapro. Remember that last time in Mexico? Remember that last time the episode? Asking me why the hell I test the code. Four times as to say don't text me, ho. Told you four times don't test me, ho. Now we finna lose all self-control. But you ain't finna be raising your voice at me. Especially when we in the Giuseppe Stowe. But I'ma have the last laugh in the end. Cause I'm from a track, I'll check a hoe. Yeah, I'ma have the laugh in the end. Cause I'm from a track, I'll check a hoe. And I wish I would go ahead and fuck my life up. Can't let them get to me. And even though I always fuck my life up, only I can mention me. Wish I would go ahead and fuck my life up. Can't let them get to me. And even though I always fuck my life up, only I can mention me. Don't stop your loving. Don't stop for nothing. They don't wanna see me love you. Don't Hey guys, just want to say thanks again to The Books for sponsoring today's podcast. They have the freshest premium flowers that you can buy anywhere. Freshly cut from sustainable and responsible farms, and the prices start at a mere $40, which is a crazy good price, especially when you consider that right now you can save $15 off of that and get free weekday delivery. So go to bouqs.com/cracked and enter code cracked. That's bouqs.com/cracked and enter the offer code cracked.
Hello, I'm John Lennon, and I'm simply having a wonderful Christmas time with all my new Earwolf merch. Just look at what Earwolf added to their store this year. Make your friends jealous, guys, with the brand new Earwolf activity book. Go on a magical mystery tour in your Hello from the Magic Tavern t-shirt. Shake it up, baby, with the longest, shortest time baby onesie. And there's gear from Comedy Bang Bang, How Did This Get Made, and so much more. Imagine all the deals. Go to store.earwolf.com today and use the promo code HOHO to get 15% off your purchase if you order by December 10th. Pick up a great gift for the podcast fan in your life this holiday season. Drums.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.